Okay, we'll go back on the record here. And I'm going to ask just again, now that we've been going for a few hours, if anybody out there, is there anybody out there who thinks they may want to testify today? If you do, please raise your hand. Okay, I'm still not seeing anybody, but I'm going to give one more shout out to that after the company closes its presentation. Mr. Morrison?
Thank you, Your Honor. We would call Todd Calvington as the final witness.
Mr. Calvington, I need you to spell your last name for me as well.
Yes, it's K-E-L-V, like Victor, I-N-G-T-O-N.
Okay, thank you. You were here when I gave the perjury admonition earlier?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, would you raise your right hand, please? You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Todd, would you state your name and give us your business address, please?
Todd Calvington. I'm at the 10K Headquarters, 100 West 5th Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And what is your position with 10K?
I'm an environmental project manager.
Have you previously testified for the Public Service Commission?
No, I've not.
Can you briefly review your educational and professional background, please?
Yes, I have a Bachelor of Science degree in biology from Norwich University and a Master's degree in environmental policy and management. Been performing environmental studies and permitting for about 17 years. Most of that in the consulting world, several years consulting to 10K. The last year and a half, I've been a 10K employee managing this work and our third-party contractors.
And did you coordinate the preparation of the environmental study and review for this project?
Yes, I did.
Can you describe for the commission the process you went through to select the route and the corridor that you're identifying today?
Sure. This project's a little unique in that we had an existing corridor that we had built through, and so we were aware of, ahead of time of some of the studies and resources that were present. But generally speaking, we partner together with our project management team, who has identified the need for a project, and they begin to lay out the potential routes and the potential facilities along that project. Our team takes that to desktop mode and evaluates what we call, you know, fatal flaws, anything that would be a major problem for that route or that facility. And then it's a collaborative process over a period of time. So through a series of meetings and a collaborative GIS system, we establish the best route with the least amount of impact.
And in this case, I think 89% is co-located with the prior existing pipeline. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, 89%.
And you agree with the prior testimony that generally the co-located pipeline will be approximately 35 feet from the existing pipeline?
Yes, I think we confirmed that you know, what we consider to be co-located was generally 35-foot pipeline-to-pipeline offset.
You said you did a desktop study. Does that generally cover a one-mile corridor?
Yes.
And then you do on-the-ground surveys, too. Is that correct?
Yeah, at the appropriate time that we feel like the route is solidified from a desktop level and we're ready to invest those resources in a field study, we deploy the resource professionals to do a complete field survey of the route.
And is that route study generally 250 feet?
Yes.
And is that what you used in this case?
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the cultural resources study. Did you cause a cultural resources inventory to be done?
Yeah, we began with a class one literature search of previously recorded sites, and as documented in the application, there were 9 previously recorded sites. All of those had previously been determined to be not eligible, and then we conduct a class three survey on the ground as well. They found one new site, a historic depression, and it was recommended as not eligible, and we received SHPO concurrence of that fact.
And that SHPO concurrence has now been filed with the PSC. Is that correct?
Yes, it has.
Did you also do a wetland and water body inventory?
Yes, sir. We used the desktop to guide our work, but we since we needed complete coverage on this line, we have walked it down from beginning to end, and using both desktop and field resources delineated those resources.
And there were some wetlands and water bodies identified. Is that correct?
Yeah, some minor features, ephemeral features, no significant water bodies, no significant wetland areas.
Are any that will be permanently affected by the project?
No.
Can you describe what the construction process will be through those wetlands or water bodies?
Well, the major resources are actually covered in that long bore. So that really made our jobs a lot easier when they decided to bore that area. So that is the major concentration of natural resources is in that low area. The others...
And that's the area that the prior witness talked about where you're going to have the basically a one-mile bore. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
The other ones are minor enough that they will... all of our crossings, we begin really with the Nationwide 12 permit from the Corps of Engineers, and we look at that criteria. And if it fits that criteria to allow us to open cut that feature, we advise the construction team of the requirements of that Nationwide 12 permit. And they kind of make that decision from a constructability standpoint. Do they want to do that with those protections, or do they want to do sort of a modified bore or other thing to avoid it? So sometimes when those features are, say, up against a roadbed that we're already boring, we'll just extend the bore past that ephemeral stream or something and take it out to the other side.
So any impacts that you have on these wetlands or water bodies are going to be temporary in nature, is that correct?
Yeah, anything that would be a an impact to a wetland or a water body would be temporary in nature, would qualify and meet the criteria of the Corps' Nationwide 12 permit.
And did you also do a wildlife inventory to determine any federally protected species or presence from?
Yes, sir, we do, and there are no protected species or critical habitat that were identified on this project.
Are there some potential habitat that you have to take some mitigation measures on?
Not directly. There are, you know, obviously potential habitat for certain migratory species that could stop over, but their listed critical habitat is not in this area. They're known they're known to pass through, but we don't have any specific mitigation for any specific species at this time.
Generally, your construction would be conducted outside their critical periods for that migration. Is that correct?
Yeah, we certainly look at that. And if for chance we were needed to build during the peak migratory bird season, we have protocols in place to sweep the area, look for migratory birds, and adjust accordingly.
Okay. And you also did consultations with a number of federal and state agencies. Is that correct?
Yes.
And those are all contained in the application that was filed?
Yes, I believe all consultations and responses are in. The only one that was filed later that's not mentioned in the application was our SHPO concurrence.
Okay.
But that has been filed.
And did any of them identify any major concerns?
No, nothing that we hadn't already addressed on our surveys or research.
Are you familiar with the Commission's identification of exclusion and avoidance areas for projects? Is that correct?
Yes.
Were any exclusion areas identified within the corridor or impacted by the route?
No.
And how about avoidance areas?
Just the one occupied structure, and that waiver has been obtained. I clarified, it's kind of a cluster of structures right there.
Okay. But waiver has been obtained from the owner
structure.
Okay.
Of those structures.
And that's been filed with the commission also, is that correct?
Yes.
What about county zoning? Have you obtained your CUP from McKenzie County?
Yes.
Sir, in your opinion, is the pipeline of such length, design, location, or purpose that it'll produce minimal adverse effects and adherence to the commission procedures and timetables requiring separate applications for corridor and route should be waived?
Yes, I believe so.
And in your opinion, will the location operation of the pipeline produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota?
Yes, I believe our strategy to co-locate this line and what we've done here is definitely the best we could do to route this project.
And is also your opinion that the proposed pipeline is compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources?
Yes, it is.
And finally, will the proposed location minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion?
Yes.
I don't have any further questions at this time.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Morning.
You just talked about the 500-foot occupied structure, and you said it was a cluster of structures. What are they? Do you know?
we could get some more details from the right-of-way group. My understanding is that there were several structures in that area. They all kind of varied in length and distance from the pipeline, but what they did is they grouped them all together and said they're all owned by the common person, and they're all within 500 feet. So we covered that in one waiver. As far as the individual uses of those, I'm not entirely sure.
And you verified that the same owner owned each individual structure within that cluster?
That's my understanding from our right-of-way group, yes.
You talked about some of the migratory animals that will go through where this proposed line will lie. Two of the ones that were pointed out in the application were the whooping crane and the red knot. Is that correct?
Yes.
You also talked about how you have some protocols in place. The application identified that there were really two protocols. One was construct outside of the migration season, and the other one was conduct environmental training with the contractor and construction crews. Is that fair to say?
Those are two methods we use, yes.
Has One Oak settled on a plan, which one of the two they're going to use at this
time? Well, I think that goes back to the testimony of Mr. Akinbola in the sense that it really depends on the schedule of when this project is needed. We have additional protocols as well if we need to construct in that time, where we do migratory bird surveys ahead of any of the clearing activity, identifying if any of those birds are utilizing our workspaces, and if buffers need to be put in place, if they're establishing nests to protect those and make exclusion buffers and such to stay out of those areas. And those are monitored by our environmental inspection team until vacated and deemed safe that we could go through those areas. So we have a process that if it's during that migratory season, we don't have any known critical habitat here or reason to believe that a whooping crane or something like that would want to be on this, but they could pass through. And so we have a process to identify that and to keep our construction activity outside of those areas until they move on.
And the process to identify that, is that the pre-clearing bird surveys that are referenced in the application?
Right. We do a couple things. We have our environmental inspection team is out in front doing those surveys. At our environment or at our construction kickoff meeting, we also inform our contractors by showing them pictures and other things of what these species look like, and informing them that if they were to happen to see anything, to inform our environmental inspection team, and they'll determine the right protocol.
And when do these surveys take place in relation to the commencement of the project?
We try to make sure that those surveys are occurring within 14 days. So no more than 14 days ahead of activity going through that area.
And is that an ongoing survey? If somebody sees something, even if it's after the initial clearing survey, will that trigger some type of stoppage or some type of adjustment in construction?
Correct.
You also mentioned that there's been correspondence between One Oak and various government agencies, and you've received responses from various government agencies. In those responses, a lot of times there's recommendations, additional recommendations, especially mm-hmm. I know North Dakota Game and Fish Department always puts out recommendations with their analysis of the situation. Will One Oak adhere to these the recommendations that are set forth by the various governmental entities that were contacted for this project?
Well, I think it would vary depending on whether it was a requirement or a general recommendation. Some of those are practices that may or may not apply to a project of this type. So they tend to send out some basic boilerplate responses to a lot of these. So an example might be the requirement to do aerial surveys for raptors. That may be appropriate in some projects. I think in this particular project, it doesn't appear to be warranted based upon the lack of known areas where that would be, so tall trees, bluffs, cliffs, things that of that nature that would require an aerial survey. Our natural resource team during the first survey of this line did line of sight visuals and to identify those, and we would do the same thing sort of during that migratory bird season, that early on pre-walk, to identify any raptor nests and such like that. So I think it would be something like that where they have a basic general recommendation of doing helicopter aerial surveys that would probably be overkill for this project.
Now, I think you said it was 89, 87% of this line is co-located, correct?
Yes.
Does One Oak have aerial evaluations of the line that's currently in the ground?
That's probably more in Travis's realm in terms of the ongoing PHMSA requirements. But yes, we are currently conducting the aerial inspections that Travis talked about that is being conducted on the existing Garden Creek line.
And I guess the purpose of my question is, since so much of this line is co-located, if there's an aerial inspection that would, you know, maybe show that there's a whooping crane habitat or a red knot habitat or something that would at least spark some interest, that would be taken into consideration for this pipeline as well, correct?
Yes, if there were habitat associated with any of those other previous stuff, they either already have been accounted for or would be accounted for in any future.
So I guess to go back to my previous question, is it fair to say that One Oak will follow the recommendations from the contacted government agencies as applicable to this project?
Yes, as applicable.
I have nothing further.
Yes, Chairman. I'm looking at the wetland and water body inventory on page 15.
Okay.
Table 5.2-1, the summary of delineated wetlands and water bodies, and it looks like there's a total of one wetland and a total of 10 water bodies. And if I understood correctly, you indicated that most of those features are present in the area where the one-mile bore is going to take place. Is that correct?
Yes, a lot of that is concentrated in that bore space.
Do you know how many will not be bored?
Not right off the top of my head, but I could get you that answer fairly shortly. If you want a breakdown of, you know, how many are open cut or how many are covered in that bore.
No other questions, Your Honor.
Okay, commissioners, questions for Mr. Kelvington.
Hi, Todd, I just have a couple. And that is, in the application, there's some conversation back and forth with the North Dakota Trust Land. Is everything completed with them in terms of routing and easements?
Yes. There was, I think, a little bit of some of that. There was some confusion as well, because at the same time that we were seeking our normal correspondence on the project from an environmental perspective, the normal notice and request for comment there, our right-of-way group was also interacting with them for actual easements. Uh-huh. And so a little bit of that might have gotten confusing in the letters. But yes, we've received the comments from the environmental perspective. We've received the comments we needed. I would have to let right away speak to any status they would have on any grants and easements.
I didn't see anything that suggested there's like final blessing from them, but that's all taken care of.
Yes.
There's no issues there.
Yes.
Okay. And then the one other, the SHPO letter of concurrence, you're still expecting that, or did that come?
It has been filed.
The exhibit two? Okay.
It's not an exhibit, but it's in the docket. I mean, it's
filed,
so it's in the record.
It's dated October 13th.
Okay.
It was filed on November 9th, if that helps.
All right. Then the only other question I had was related to the USDA. This is the first time I've seen this, actually, or maybe noticed it. They say that there's no construction between April and August on CRP land. Is there any CRP land in this area?
No, there's not.
Okay, great. That's all my questions.
Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Todd, for your testimony. The you'd said that there was 9 previously found ARC sites that none were deemed eligible, and there was one new one.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what would be a ARC site that would cause concern that then deemed not eligible? Like, what does that really mean?
So it has to do with the archaeologists and SHPO and their classification of the find. So they identify a resource in various ways in the field, but then they have to go through a process.
Can you give me an example, though? I mean,
maybe it would be a stone tool, a piece of pottery, or, you know, something of that nature, a fragment, indication of some activity, historic, prehistoric activity. Then they go through a process of determining whether or not that particular find or site is eligible for
listing. When you say they, you mean your guys or the ARC guys in Bismarck?
So our archaeologist, in consultation with Bismarck, go through a process to determine if it meets any of the criteria to be eligible for listing on the National Historic Register.
Okay.
And so it's that process of whether or not it's connected to an important event, an important person. So they have a list of criteria that they go through and evaluate that find.
And I'm sure we could look at your detailed application and probably tell us exactly what you found and what the determinations were.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. Most likely this is some sort of, you know, lithic scatter of, you know, pieces of stone okay. type thing that archaeologists are very tuned to seeing. But then when they go through the process, it is either.
I have no idea what a lithic scatter is.
Yeah, it's.
But sounds good.
I'm going to use that.
A lot of times, particularly in these areas, they've been heavily disturbed by agricultural activity.
Sure, right.
And exactly. That's one of the criteria is that if they document through their testing in the field, yeah, we found something, but it's been significantly damaged by plowing, tractors, all of these activity.
Okay.
Then it's
because one thing that, and I think that's been reported on before, but one thing that the energy boom has really helped the state is find more of these archaeological sites. And most of these sites that we found have been in this part of the state. And so I appreciate what you guys are doing. And then the last line of questions, I should have maybe thought of it for the engineer guy, but when you talked about the bore, so you can be able to avoid all the wetlands, but it's a 16-inch pipe. Do you know how big this bore is going to be and how that would maybe tie into the archaeological review? I mean, if you happen to go through a burial ground, how would you know that in a bore?
Well, I think in a bore that might be difficult. Certainly in our excavation, well, the first thing we do is the desktop and the field studies to find anything that we can and route accordingly to avoid that circumstance. So then there is the other side of it, which is we call unanticipated finds.
Right.
So in the course of all of this work, you always run the risk of excavating your trench and uncovering something you didn't have any reason to know was there. And so we have a process for that during excavation and how our contractor should react, and we train them on that, and then we interact with SHPO and determine, is it important, what is it, how do we
do you know the depth of the bore?
I don't. That would definitely be an engineering question. I know we have a bore profile set up. We do so many of those. I'd probably be guessing if I told you how deep the bore is. It's on a curve.
Sure.
So it's going to vary in depth as it goes down to the bottom at its apex, and it works its way back up. So that's in the excavation sense. In the bore sense, I guess we could see things in our drilling mud returns. As we push through, there is that return that comes back from our lubricating mud. You could notice some things in there that maybe would.
But you've got a plan in place.
And that's we would trigger that plan. Hey, I don't. What is that in the drilling mud? And that would start that process.
Okay.
But we don't knowingly drill
absolutely
under or directly through any of those sites.
All right. Thank you, Todd. That was all I had.
Commissioner Christman.
I only have one, and regarding the conversation you had with Commissioner Kalk about these archaeological sites, you talked only about lithic scatters and other prehistoric sure. things, but are they all prehistoric? Or I always thought that some of the reason why we start with a large volume isn't like old farm machinery that's maybe 100 years old and was abandoned sure. there. That adds up in that total, too, when it turns out it's just another abandoned binder or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's same process, just historic instead of prehistoric, and so it could be a farmhouse of you know, maybe architectural, and so they have to determine the same thing: is it eligible?
Okay.
Is it of unique nature that there's research potential that we would want to preserve it or research it before there's any damage to it? But it's the same process of determining, is it connected with someone important? Is it add to the research potential? And that's a process we go through with SHPO. Whenever they identify those, the archaeologist goes through the process and has a recommendation. We believe it is ineligible, and then SHPO provides concurrence. We agree. So that's what we have in that concurrence letter, is an agree upon the classification of all the things we found.
Okay, thank you. No other questions.
Mr. Morrison, any redirect?
No redirect.
We had a couple of issues where Mr. Covington alluded to the right-of-way people and maybe getting back on some things. Are those things you want to try to tie up somehow? Maybe if we took a little break or something.
Yeah, I think there was an issue whether state land department was resolved.
And then there was the one, Ms. Prescott's question about water bodies outside the bore area.
Oh, where all the water bodies are located? Okay.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we want
to let's take a break. We can
perfect the record
sure,
on that.
Sure, that's fine.
Why don't we take a little break and if maybe you can do that through Mr. Covington then? Or
that's fine.
Sure.
Okay. We'll take like a...